You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 2nd of May 2016 on Monocle 24. The Briefing in association with Air Canada. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Ahead today, the European Commission is set to recommend visa-free travel for some 80 million Turkish citizens. Dutch MEP Sophie Intveld is among many raising concerns over the plan.
Because if the Turkish government intends to convince Parliament to vote for visa liberalisation, cracking down on journalists is not a very good strategy.
And I don't like the world and I want to get off. That is David Miliband's summary of the Great British Brexit campaign.
The Leave campaign don't actually argue the case. They question the bona fides or the legitimacy or the standing of those who are making the case. So they say, don't listen to the IMF because they're the IMF. Don't listen to Barack Obama because he's Barack Obama.
We'll have more when Monocle's New York bureau chief sits down with the former British Foreign Secretary, widely tipped for a top job in Hillary Clinton's White House. Plus, budget night in Australia and the industries in Brazil rising above the chaos. That is today on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. And we start today's program with a look at some of today's front pages. Monocle's Ben Ryland is in the studio with me. How are you doing this Monday?
Hello, Marcus. Good to be here with you. Look, we should start today with the New York Times, I think. Stricter rules for voter IDs are starting to reshape the races. That's according to an article in the New York Times today by Michael Wines and Manny Fernandez. This article is based out of San Antonio, which is described as a state where everything is big. The 23rd Congressional District that hugs the border with Mexico is a monster, according to the opener in this article. But it's really all about how voter IDs have reshaped a few of the ways in which votes are counted in some states. But basically, it all comes down to people asking for a driver's license, which has been the law in some of these voting districts for about a decade now.
And then moving on to other stories for this day, where we're heading next.
Still on the election front, Ted Cruz's support is softening amongst the delegates that he courted. So, of course, Ted Cruz was doing quite well in some of the more, shall we say, obscure states that Donald Trump couldn't quite round up. But now, according to some new polls, he's even starting to dive in those states as well. He's facing a potentially candidacy-threatening contest on Tuesday in Indiana, according to an NBC News and Wall Street Journal poll released yesterday, showing him trailing Donald Trump by about 15 percentage points. Not good news for him at all.
Not at all. And then the Washington Post.
The Washington Post. Interesting article here today by Robert McCartney and Lori Aratani. They've been having a look at the safety concerns among the metro system over there in Washington lately. And there have been quite a few concerns. So this article here is a bit of a feature all about how that has reached the point where it's almost at crisis at the moment. They're pointing to a finding on the 10th of April where federal safety inspectors are checking the system as part of a safety blitz, found incorrectly fastened rails along more than 38 feet of pocket track. That's not good news for anyone catching the metro over there, obviously. Very quick look today at the newspapers here in the UK. Jeremy Corbyn, the opposition leader here in the United Kingdom, is attracting quite a bit of controversy after vowing to continue talking to terrorist organisations, as described here in The Telegraph today. They are referring to Hamas and Hezbollah. That's in The Telegraph today. And just a quick look at the Australian front pages as well. The Age out of Melbourne has uncovered the man behind Bitcoin. Apparently he's been outed as the Australian Craig Stephen Wright.
Do you think you Australians feel proud now?
I'm really not sure how Australians would feel about that. Bitcoin was a bit of a flat balloon, I think, nowadays. It seemed it was such an easy thing to get press coverage for a while there, but now I don't think anyone really cares anymore, do they, Marcus?
I don't know. That was Monocle's Ben Ryland with this day's front pages. And after that, we continue with some of the day's top business news. I'm joined now by Bloomberg's Pim Fox, who is in New York. Welcome to the program. So what's going on in New York today?
Well, a lot. not. People are going to be digesting the comments by Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway, because at his capitalist convention in Omaha, which is the annual meeting of Berkshire Hathaway, he said that hedge funds are a ripoff. He was speaking to the hundreds of shareholders that were gathered in Omaha, and he was talking about high-fee money managers who often underperform the market. So there's going to be a lot of reaction to that. Also, Halliburton, Baker Hughes, another merger, a victim of low oil prices. They have called off their $28 billion merger. It did also meet with stiff antitrust resistance from regulators in the United States and Europe, so people will be digesting that information. Also, the yen, Japanese yen, hovering near an 18-month high. I guess it is a sign of a risk-off trade, people buying the Japanese yen. And also, people will be looking at Puerto Rico today because they are defaulting on a $422 million bond payment for the government's development bank. It'll be a major default, and it'll certainly spur Congress to discuss, if not solve, the problems of Puerto Rico's finances.
Thank you, Pim. That was Pim Fox from Bloomberg, and you're listening to The Briefing.
When you're travelling overseas, travel at the top, aboard Air Canada's International Business Class. Completely unwind in executive pods with seats that lie flat and indulge in signature Canadian dining. All inside a modernised cabin designed to reduce jet lag. We look forward to welcoming you aboard.
It is 7 minutes past the hour. The European Commission is set to hand down a recommendation for visa-free travel across Europe for Turkish citizens. The move is one of the main conditions from Turkey's landmark deal back in March, which saw Ankara cut migrant numbers by taking back those who arrive on the Greek islands. Well, the loosening of regulations will affect about 80 million Turkish citizens, but Turkey still falls short of many EU standards, and some are concerned the Union may be bargaining illegally too liberally with its own rules. I'm joined now on the line by Sony Kapoor, Managing Director of Redefine Think Tank. He's travelling in Oslo today. Welcome to the programme. What is your understanding? Does the European Commission really have alternatives than to recommend visa-free travel for Turkish citizens?
Not really. I think neither politically nor ethically, because the visa regulations are a bit outdated. It is the 21st century, and the restrictiveness of EU Schengen visa rules is known to anybody who's tried to obtain one. Turkey is our geographic partner. It is our closest neighbor to the south. It is part of the EU future membership, and it will someday hopefully become a member. And frankly, it's just really, really delayed that it is getting the Schengen access deal. So I think it's politically and ethically expedient for the Commission to be allowing Turkey to get this deal now.
Sony, there's been a lot of talk about that catalogue of 72 benchmarks required of applicant countries. To which extent is the Commission and the European Union now sticking to its own rules if it's going to offer Turkish citizens visa-free travel?
For the most part, the direction of movement is very clear. Turkey has demonstrated a very serious intention of meeting all the commitments. I think it's passed 15 new commitments within just the past 2 weeks or so. And for the most part, more and more of these would be complete. And it is, again, out of 72, perhaps if it meets 65, if it meets 60, if it meets 70, surely something of this strategic and political importance cannot and should not be held back by one or two minor bureaucratic misses. And I think it will not be.
And when you look at the systems of making sure that those people who come from Turkey actually are the ones that are to be allowed to enter Schengen area, for example, how safe system, how reliable system does Turkey have at the moment?
Well, I mean, it's primarily this deal is not about refugees. This is the counterpart for Turkish citizens. So if you have a Turkish passport, then you will be allowed visa-free travel within the Schengen area. And the question then is, how easy is it to obtain a fake Turkish passport, but then how easy is it to obtain a stolen British or a French passport? And the answer is, I don't think there is any more systematic risk in allowing Turkish citizens in than allowing other people carrying fake or stolen passports that are already eligible for EU visa-free access. So I don't think that is in itself an issue. And this deal only applies to Turkish citizens.
What do you think are the biggest issues then if Turkish citizens are offered visa-free travel?
Frankly, I don't think there is a big serious risk. I think this is a step in the right direction in demonstrating that the EU is serious about considering Turkish membership of the European Union. The fact that this deal comes with the same deal being also offered to Ukraine is also encouraging. It means that the European Union, rather than looking inwards and navel-gazing as it has been because of the euro crisis, is once again seriously looking at its neighbourhood, is seriously looking at its expansion strategy, which has been a great force for both economic prosperity and peace building. And I think this will be a good signal, and President Erdogan will be forced, is being forced to pass some measures that he may not like, but which are part of making Turkey into a more open liberal society. And the future of Turkey belongs within the European Union. This is good demographically and economically for the European Union, which needs migrants, which needs younger workforces. And Turkey is one of the faster growing economies, and it's good for Turkey itself.
And at the same time, there is a lot of disagreement about this development when you look at the leaders of European Union countries. So the European Commission is expected to recommend visa-free travel for Turkish citizens on Wednesday. And then after that, the final decision on whether to grant Turks visa-free travel is expected in June. And that rests with member country leaders. What do you expect to happen then?
There will be a lot of discussion. It will definitely not be unanimous, but legally, all that is required is a majority. And I think Germany, which is by far the biggest proponent of this deal, because it is this deal that significantly reduced the number of migrants coming into Greece and into Germany, will manage to get its way with maybe a few member states that will oppose, some others will abstain. But from the European Council, there should be an agreement, not a unanimous one, but a unanimous one is not legally required. The European Parliament also has to approve this, and it is a bit unpredictable on these matters, and it may insist on Turkey meeting all the 72 requirements or put in some other stumbling blocks on the way. But I think that the overwhelming political case, the case that this is the only real way in the near term to reduce the number of migrant flows, which Turkey has managed to do. And so Turkey has held up most of its end of the bargain. And if the EU fails to, including the European Parliament, then the number of migrants coming in will once again increase. Turkey has very clearly stated that. And I think that one way or the other, either in June or if not in June, a few months down the line, this deal will happen.
That was Sonia Kapoor, who is the managing director of Redefine Think Tank. Thank you very much. Former British Foreign Secretary David Miliband has told Monocle that campaigners calling for a British exit from Europe are taking a dangerous short-term view. The former British Foreign Secretary now runs a humanitarian relief organisation and has warned of a surge in right-wing reactionaries with the refugee crisis gripping much of the continent. Miliband has earned plenty of credentials in this realm since he was beaten to the British Labour Party leadership by his own brother. Now he is widely tipped as a candidate for a big job in the White House if Hillary Clinton wins this year's presidential election. In the first part of this interview, Monocle's New York bureau chief Ed Stock visited Mr. Miliband at his Midtown office.
First of all, maybe you can tell me, and you can word this differently, but how much of a threat to global stability do you think the current refugee crisis is?
I think that the scale of displacement and the length of displacement
is definitely one of the shocks to the global system, the global economic and political system. And it's striking to have you start with that question, because people always know in their bones that political crisis causes humanitarian suffering. The point you're making is that untreated humanitarian suffering itself becomes a source of political instability. And that's something we've been saying for 2 or 3 years. But obviously, if you look at the situation in Europe today, you can see that. But frankly, also, the challenges in the Middle East, in Kenya, in Pakistan, any country that's hosting large numbers of refugees. And remember, most refugees, 85% of them, are in poor countries, not in rich countries. It's undoubtedly a source of instability. And so I see the refugee challenge, the refugee management challenge, as a humanitarian challenge, but it's also a challenge to the global commons. The dignified treatment of refugees is a global public good, and it's one that we are not properly addressing at the moment.
Arguably, too, the refugee crisis is influencing politics in Europe in countries such as Austria, which had an election recently. How do you see it influencing the referendum in the UK in June?
I think that the battle is on between those of us who argue that we should remain in Europe, who are making a long-term case for the prosperity, security, stability of the United Kingdom, and those who want to surf a short-term wave of anger about migration and refugees, which seems to be the only argument or the only case that's being made for those who want to leave. It's a sort of, I don't like the world, let me get off point of view. I think that one hopes that over the next 2 months, the scale of the decision, the importance of the decision becomes clear to British people. I think it will. British people are very level-headed. And I think that the weight of argument is so abundantly on the side of Remain. It's very striking to me, in response to arguments from the IMF, from President Obama, never mind from the UK government or UK political parties, the Leave campaign don't actually argue the case. They question the bona fides or the legitimacy or the standing of those who are making the case. So they say, don't listen to the IMF, because they're the IMF. Don't listen to Barack Obama, because he's Barack Obama. And I think that's telling, because it speaks to a paucity of argument on the Leave side that is frankly crater-wide.
And why have you chosen to get involved in this discussion? What has made you want to voice your opinion on the Brexit or not?
I got involved to the extent that I made a speech when I was in London doing a lot of humanitarian business and took some time out to make a personal contribution to the campaign. There's a very simple answer to your question, which is I'm a citizen. I'm a British voter. Abraham Lincoln said the hardest job in the world is to be a citizen. And as a British citizen, I feel it's legitimate for me to have a say. Given my experience in government, I think that I've got something to say.
And what role do you see Britain having in the Union and in the world?
I think that Britain's role in the European Union can be a leadership role. But you can't be a leadership role if you've got your hand on the door handle to leave. And so I think it's very important that we develop a forward agenda for the Europe of the future, because the truth is that the problems facing the world are demanding more cooperation between states. Global governance is a long way off, so regional cooperation is the way of the future.
Do you think someone like Barack Obama should get involved in this, or is he meddling in sovereign affairs of the UK?
Barack Obama's totally right to get involved. He is involved because he will bear the consequences, some of the consequences of the decision. I always say to people that a decision to leave would be bad for Britain, but it would also be bad for the rest of the world. And as the leader of the free world, it's absolutely right that he speaks his mind. I think he's also done some truth-telling, because remember, the leave argument is premised on the idea that the hubristic idea that by leaving, we'll have more power. It's nonsense. And Barack Obama has pricked that bubble very appropriately.
And what do you make of Boris Johnson's comments about why Barack Obama made the statement that he did?
I think that everyone realises that when you resort to personal abuse, you've lost the argument, and Boris lost the argument.
Do you think he's taking a leaf out of Trump's book?
I'm running a $700 million NGO that has got 22,000 staff in the riskiest environments. I'm not here to commentate on the latest outpourings of Boris Johnson.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, obviously you are based in the US, in New York, as you were saying. How alarmed have you been by some of the discourse in the US elections about Syrian refugees, for example?
I think that the atmosphere is quite toxic, that Donald Trump's, not just suggestion, but plan or proposal, I think, rather than plan, to ban all Muslims from entering the US appalled many Americans, because it spoke so directly against the history of the country. We are an international humanitarian aid organisation that's also a refugee resettlement organisation in 26 US cities. And there are two things that I would say to an audience listening to this broadcast. One is that it's not right to say that there's simply a backlash against refugees in the US. The US scene that I see is one of polarization, not of backlash. Backlash suggests a one-way movement. Polarization means that for every person who's fearful or angry about refugees coming to the country, there's another person who's actually saying this is part of America's DNA and we should welcome people who are fleeing violence and give them a chance to start their lives again. So it's important for people to know that the better angels of American nature are still there in this debate. Secondly, I always say to people that it's not just right to welcome refugees to the US or elsewhere. It's right, it's practical, and it's smart. It's right for obvious reasons because these are people with a well-founded fear of persecution. It's practical because the US has previously resettled 150 or even 200,000 refugees a year in the 1980s. And third reason is that it's smart to do so because, remember, the central claim of those who would do the US and other Western countries damage, notably Daesh, but Al-Qaeda and others, their argument is that Muslims can't prosper in Western countries. And so actually welcoming refugees from a place like Syria and letting them restart their lives is something that's a smart thing to do as well as an appropriate thing to do and a practical thing to do.
David Miliband there in conversation with Monocle's Ed Stocker. And we'll have more of that interview with David Miliband on tomorrow's edition of The Globalist here on Monocle 24. That is live from 7 a.m. London time. You are listening to The Briefing and we head to Sydney after a short break.
Discover the wide world in a quiet cabin just for you. Air Canada's premium economy class gives travellers the comfort of a larger seat in a dedicated cabin. Enjoy premium cuisine and amenities that will make the furthest destination seem closer. We look forward to welcoming you aboard.
It is 20:22 in Tokyo, 14:22 in Helsinki, 12:22 here in London and 7:22 a.m. in New York City. The Australian Prime Minister says substantial changes to the country's tax system are in store as he prepares to hand down his budget before an election is officially called. It is understood Malcolm Turnbull will distance his brand of governance from his predecessor's disastrously unpopular 2014 budget, though despite being deeply divisive among young voters, the so-called negative gearing tax loophole will remain unchanged. The Federal Treasurer Scott Morrison says it is all about jobs and growth.
Well, budgets often in different cycles are a list of measures. That's not what this budget is. This is an economic plan for jobs and growth for a stronger new economy. This is the path that we're clearing so Australians can continue to make their way forward in this difficult global economy. And they are making the way.
And for more on this, I'm joined by the journalist Dan Illick in Sydney. Welcome to the programme. So the new budget is to be released in less than 24 hours. Can you outline how much is known of that by now?
Well, Marcus, I tell you what, I'm excited and you must be excited as well. There are people lining up around the streets ready to buy their copies of the budget. It's like Harry Potter here. It's the best book that gets released every year. People are just into it. It's one of those things where you're kind of figuring out a little bit about the country when it happens. It's like the closest we get to the State of the Union.
And there has been a lot of talk about, obviously everyone remembers the, say, 2014 budget. What was so bad about that? Why was there such a backlash then? And in contrast of what is expected from this new budget, what do you think are going to be the biggest similarities and differences?
The 2014 budget was released under former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, and that was very much deemed to be a very severe cut to the underprivileged in Australia. A lot of essential services were cut, and also a very anti-intellectual budget. What we did see was science receiving huge cuts right across the board, including cuts to the much lauded CSIRO and other institutions as well. So this budget is we don't know for certain, but it is kind of hoped that this will be a bit of an answer to that budget, a more fairer budget. The rhetoric sure is spewing out of Scott Morrison's mouth as fast as he can spew it, but we're kind of hoping that this budget will address
address some of those inequities of the last budget?
There was a lot of expectations about the so-called negative gearing. What is the latest on that?
Well, there has been a lot of anticipation that the government will actually move on negative gearing to actually address many problems which economists say that negative gearing is artificially inflating house prices in Australia, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. This may be of no surprise to you, Marcus, as someone who lives in London, but it is certainly a massive surprise to me. In Sydney, the average house price is about $1 million. And so if you're a first-time home buyer, you're very much like unlikely to pick up a house within anywhere near that kind of money. Now, so a lot of economists have suggested negative gearing, it's time for it to go, but the government's put its foot down to basically say, look, we're not going to touch that within this budget period. They may move on it, maybe in about a year or two.
Okay, that is to be expected then, happening a bit later. That was journalist Dan Illick on the line from Sydney. And finally on today's programme, it has not been a terribly good year for Brazil so far. Economy in recession, the Zika virus, a political crisis that could see President Dilma Rousseff impeached just in time for the world to tune in for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. But there are some industries that are rising above the chaos and doing quite well as well. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco tells us more.
The Brazilian economy is in trouble. In 2015, the country fell into recession, its GDP falling by close to 4%, the worst performance in 25 years. This year, despite, or perhaps because of, the Olympic Games taking place in Rio, things will be no better. But in the face of these challenges, there are some industries that are defying the odds. Take pet shops, for example. Brazilians really love their pets. You might think that this is not particular to Brazil, but look at the numbers. There are more dogs as pets than there are children in Brazil. The country is home to more than 132 million pets and is the second largest pet shop market in the world, just behind the US and way ahead of the third-placed UK. Even in tough times, Brazilians are not prepared to economize when it comes to their beloved animals. The sector was up close to 8% last year, and the luxury market for pets is doing particularly well. In a country where therapy is commonplace, it should perhaps be little surprise that the number of dog psychologists is on the rise. As well as pet shop proprietors, movie distributors are a happy bunch too. The country saw another record-breaking year at the box office. Attendance rose 7% last year, and revenue for the movie industry soared by a whopping 16%. And a funny thing aside, each of the top 10 Brazilian films last year was a comedy. The success of films like Loucas para Casar, panned by the critics, but hugely popular, suggests that a public depressed by economic travails and political corruption can still find plenty to smile about.
Quando tudo parecia estar dando certo.
Seis? Como assim seis?
O cara que eu tô namorando há 3 anos, o homem perfeito, provavelmente tem uma amante.
Another industry that is shaping up very well, despite the crisis, is the personal fitness sector, which is responsible for more than 300,000 jobs in Brazil. The industry is going, appropriately enough, from strength to strength. With the Olympic Games this year keeping a focus on all things sport and well-being, Brazil should consolidate its position as the second biggest fitness market in the world, just behind the United States.
Tem que correr, tem que suar, tem que malhar, vamos lá. Musculação, respiração, ar no pulmão, vamos lá. Tem que esticar, tem que dobrar.
And whisper it quietly, but for those eager to look good, but perhaps less keen on hard graft and working up a sweat, there's always the still booming plastic surgery and Botox industry. There were more than 1.3 million surgeries in 2014 alone. Perhaps all the Brazilian economy needs, after all, is a little bit of a nip and a tuck here and there. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And you have been listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And that's all for this edition of this program. The Briefing was produced by Ben Ryan and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mari Giusti. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Up next, Ben continues with today's Continental Shift for about 30 minutes. Great tracks from around the world. After that, it is the news headlines, obviously, at the top of the hour. Then the Bulletin with UBS, followed by the Urbanist Monocle's program on great cities and people living in them. And then a bit later, Andrew Miller in the studio for today's edition of Midori House at 1800 London time. This program, The Briefing, is back tomorrow at the same time. I am Marcus Hippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.